Welcome to the Joint Angel Poll and Angel Capital Association conference call. This is Michael Price of CEO Ventures. I serve as the 2011 volunteer chair of angelpoll.org, and I'll be moderating today's call. We have an excellent speaker on angel capital best practices today, Jeff Clavier, managing partner of SoftTech VC. Before we begin, just some quick housekeeping announcements. Everyone is currently in mute. A number of questions were submitted in advance that we'll be working our way through, but if you have any burning questions during the first part, please press star 6 to unmute your mic and go ahead and ask your question. And please barge in, and don't be shy, as it's typically a fairly loud group, and typically the speaker is trying to be loud and project their voices as well as they can. Again, just please press star 6 again after asking your question so that background noise does not get out of hand. After the panelists' remarks, I will then remind everyone how to unmute their phones again to ask questions. Just remember to press star 6 again right after asking your question to reduce the background noise. If anyone would like to watch the presentation as it's being delivered, you may go to the following address. It is simply angelpoll.org/view. Again, angelpoll, as in swimming pool, .org/view. So again, angelpoll.org/view, and that should allow you to then immediately see the slides. And by the way, once you are viewing the slides, if you click anywhere on any one of the pages, it allows you to make comments or ask questions. So feel free to use that feature again. For those joining the call for the first time, both angelpoll.org and the Angel Capital Association are organizations of volunteer leaders who help angel groups across North America and are dedicated to helping their leadership build strong angel groups in their cities to drive jobs, innovation, and exciting new companies. For those angel groups that need additional capital to complete a seed round or that would like access to more deal flow, the Angel Poll Syndication Network is now the world's largest, providing easy monthly access to a large number of other angel groups and deals within their region. This also provides the members of each angel group total visibility into all the best deals in their region. AngelPoll.org also organizes knowledge and educational events like this one to share best practices and lift each other's angel skills and knowledge. The Angel Capital Association provides in-person syndication meetings at both the regional and national levels, which is also highly valuable, along with exceptional training courses, conferences, and many other key functions, such as serving as a public policy voice of the angel community. This ensures each angel group and their angels better fulfill their missions of helping entrepreneurs be more successful so that our portfolios, in turn, will also be more successful. With that, let's go ahead and begin. Again, for those late joiners, if you'd like to view the presentation, simply go to angelpoll.org/view. Again, angelpoll.org/view to view it. And then we've got a special request by Jeff, who will be presenting. If you can give him tips or indications by just clicking on the screen at any time, I'll then relay those comments to him so that he can adjust his presentation on the fly. So with that, today's speaker again is Jeff Clavier, managing partner of SoftTech VC. He'll be speaking on angel investing in capital-efficient lean startups, myths and realities. As background, Jeff is based in Palo Alto, California, and SoftTech VC is one of the most active seed stage investors in Web 2.0 startups. Since 2004, Jeff has invested in close to 100 consumer internet startups in Fund 1, Fund 2, and Fund 3 in areas like social media, monetization, search, gaming, or B2B and B2C web services. These investments are typically located in Silicon Valley, New York, and Boulder. With over 20 years of operational, entrepreneurial, and venture capital experience, Jeff is able to add relevant experience and perspective to his companies as they grow from inception to maturity and hopefully success. In 2007, Jeff was recognized as one of the 13 Web 2.0 kingmakers by Business 2.0, and Business Week named him one of the 25 most influential people on the web in 2008. And one of the top 25 angels in tech in 2010. He was also nominated in the best angel categories at the Crunchies in 2009 and 2010. He is often noted for his investments in categories such as passion-centric communities or online gaming, and for having sold a number of his Web 2.0 startups to the likes of Yahoo, AOL, Intuit, or more recently, Twitter and Groupon. In September 2007, after successfully investing as a business angel, Jeff announced the formation of SoftTech VC 2 LP, a $15 million seed fund backed by a mix of institutional and private investors, to invest in 60-plus consumer internet companies over 3 years. Some of Jeff's representative investments include Mint, which was sold to Intuit, the Bright Roll, Truvio, which was sold to AOL, Userplane, sold to AOL, Rapleaf, Ustream, Milo, sold to eBay, Ableco, Eventbrite, Tapulous, sold to Disney, DNA Nexus, FanBridge, Billfloat, and more. Jeff, with that, welcome, and thank you very much for volunteering your time to help the Angel community, and the podium is all yours.
Michael, thank you so much. So I'm thrilled to be here, and I hope that over the next hour we'll be able to talk together about capital efficiency and what has impacted really in the world of early stage financing and why it has enabled really a new sub-asset class that many people refer to as the micro VCs. Michael, you already went through a bit of my background, so let's just go through the few slides I had prepared. So if you can move to that would be great.
Yeah, thank you. And by the way, Jeff, we are having a few technical difficulties, so just press on, if you will, and we'll catch up with the slides in one moment.
Okay. So essentially the slides was just a way to summarize some of the information that Michael has shared with you. So I'll just introduce myself a little bit. So I'm French. I was born, raised, and educated in France. I have a Master of Science in Computer Science and a minor in Distributed Computing. And that minor in Distributed Computing has led me in the world of finance, getting me to build a lot of the real-time systems that created the migration from green screen TVs to digital sort of deployment of real-time data in trading floors in 1988, 1989. And we built a startup called FX that we eventually sold to Reuters, which is still at Thomson Reuters, one of the giants of the information world, back in 1993. I was the CTO of the company, scaled it from about 20 developers to 250 with teams in Paris, New York, London, and Palo Alto. And one of my claim to fame is to have built the Bloomberg killer that never killed Bloomberg, so to speak. My move to venture took place in 2000, and I relocated from Paris to Silicon Valley in August 2000, which is obviously an interesting timing to become a VC. And I spent a lot of my time actually working with my partners on, you know, a few sort of interesting but troubled investments that they made in 1999-2000, like so many VCs. Michael, if you could move to the next slide, we'll come back on this one. Next one on my bio. Sorry. The next one, page five.
Okay, 1 second. There we go.
Yes, this one. Sorry. After 4 years as a traditional VC, I started seeing the opportunity to invest in a new breed of startup companies that had one common characteristic. They were actually very capital efficient in the sense that $250,000, $700,000 would allow them to actually launch a product and have a first level of market penetration, whereas 5 years prior, when I started to invest as a venture capitalist, the same company would have needed $5 million to do that. And that created essentially a real opportunity for individuals and smaller funds to really make a difference in that market. My partners were not interested to invest in consumer internet. You know, back in 2003, 2004, people were still sort of dealing with the aftermath of the Internet 1.0 bubble burst, and so there wasn't a lot of enthusiasm behind this concept of funding what became Web2O. And so I left my firm to start SoftTech VC back in May of 2004, so, you know, 7 years ago, and really started to invest my own money as a business angel, hustling my way into what I thought were interesting deals. And having A, my first portfolio of fund one, and B, my sort of reputation and access to opportunities over 3.5 years. And I sort of think about this as my bootstrapping phase of sorts. So for me, SoftTech is actually a startup, and yes, it's a startup that happens to invest in other startups, but still, the way we've actually approached the opportunity was completely different from traditional VCs. And after 3.5 years as a business angel, I had the opportunity to raise my first fund, which was a 3C2, which was a $15 million fund that really was my attempt to figure out what an institutional version of my angel strategy would look like. And so raised that fund and deployed it over 3.5 years, investing in 65 companies. And having sort of really figured out the model, if you want, that allows you to provide superior returns to investors by investing at that level, at that stage, the early stage, the seed stage, I then decided to go for a slightly larger vehicle. So SoftTech VC3, which I did the first close of in December of 2010, and will be a larger, you know, a vehicle of $35 million and up, and will apply the same strategy, investing in roughly 65-70 companies over 3 years. Our sort of mental sort of pace is about 2 deals a month. And we'll invest in the same sectors, consumer internet. We'll go through that in a couple of minutes. And the difference between Fund 3 and Fund 2 is that Fund 3 is much more focused on building ownership, not the typical sort of 20-25% ownership that traditional VCs will seek, but will build a, 5-10% ownership in about 20 companies a year at seed stage. And then we'll do a few Series A's and Series B's where the ownership will be lower, but the amount invested, roughly, you know, 250 to 750, will be about the same. In terms of sectors that we invest in, if you want to move to the next slide, Michael, please. That's my partner, Charles Hudson, who's joined me since the beginning of the year. And up until the end of last year, I was on my own. So I built a portfolio of about 95 investments just on my own between in 2004 to 2007. And now, as we're raising a larger fund, we're starting to scale. So Charles is my first partner, and we'll be looking at bringing in another partner later in the year. Can we move to slide 7? So this is the first portfolio we built, which was Fund 1. So some names you might recognize are Mint or Congregate, Trulia, that we sold very early to AOL. So this was essentially just a portfolio of investments that I built using my own money. Fund 2, if you want to move to the next slide, is slightly busier. This is where we have spent essentially 3.5 years building this set of companies, bringing them in mostly, actually all of them, at seed stage. So we're part of the first 500,000, 750,000 million that got those companies off the ground. And then for a few of them, we actually participated to their follow-on round. And so a typical angel will not follow on. We actually have some reserves to follow on. And it's not so much protect our positions, but it's make sure that we can actually double down on our winners. So we've had a few outcomes. 10 companies have already been acquired. Some of them were just, you know, what I call the recycle, which is put some money in, company sort of works, but, you know, doesn't really take off, has an early exit, you know, we take the money back into the fund to recycle it. Some others did really well for us, like Milo, which was companies for stock. So that's how we got into Groupon and Twitter and Glam Media early, which means that, you know, if the rumored Groupon IPO goes ahead, we'll do extremely well on that exit. And then Fund 3, if you can move to the next slide. Great. So we just started investing in that venture portfolio. We have done a total of 15 investments in Fund 3. Six of them were warehoused last year, so companies that we really wanted to invest from Fund 3 with a larger investment dollar in. So they were kind enough to wait for us. And then we've been doing roughly two deals a month since the beginning of the year. And so today we announced, for example, the launch of Fab, which is a flash sales for design product, which we're pretty excited to have joined. If you want to go back to the first slide, so we can sort of get back to in the flow. Okay, so we sort of talked about this, and so slide three, sorry. Yes. So what we do essentially is, since we're a fund and we have limited partners, is we have to try to figure out how to build a strategy to really take advantage of this new funding environment that is really sort of bolt-on to leverage capital efficiency. And so for us, we think that the best way to deliver superior returns to our investors is to have a very selective investment sort of strategy and filters, and only invest in about 20 deals a year. And I know that 20 deals a year seems to be a very high number. And there was a time back in 2007 when I launched Sustainable VC, where doing 20 deals a year was crazy. But now it's almost, you know, being extremely conservative to only do 20 deals a year. And we think that having at least a minimum concentration across a portfolio like the one we're building and buying ownership 5-10% in those companies and having the reserves and the ability to selectively follow on is sort of the best way for us to just, you know, essentially deliver a very hefty both cash on cash and IRR to our limited partners. So let's dig in the topic of today, which is capital efficiency and what does that mean. So just to do a flashback, 12 years ago, if you had an internet startup, you know, you basically had maybe a bit of friends and family capital to get you going for a few weeks or a few months, but that was only to work on the concept, because as soon as you wanted to actually build something, very quickly you had to start buying, you know, software, hardware, spend some money on marketing, you know, hire people, and the typical wisdom was that $3 to $5 million is what it took. You know, roughly $1 million in hardware, $1 million in software, $1 million in marketing, $2 million in sort of people. It's a very rough cut, but the point is that you really had to invest in your initial infrastructure and your launch infrastructure, you know, to be able to get a product out the door. Which means that at that time, VCs were really sort of gatekeepers of innovation because in order to raise $5 million, you couldn't sort of go to your grandma unless she was really, you know, doing well, and get those $5 million. And so it was sort of a process to try and convince people to invest in you on a PowerPoint, which obviously is very tricky because you can't see the product, you can't do a minimum set of validation on the product with potential customers, and it's much riskier, I would say, to execute on that strategy. Fast forward in 2003-2004, what we started seeing was, you know, companies which were able to get early prototypes out the door, give access to early alpha users and get initial feedback portion of the stack of software that you require. You need to actually build those products, which were open source. And so the $1 million you would have spent in software licenses was down to zero. We started having, you know, clearly very cheap hardware, and you started having a few of the initial sort of hosters. We didn't really have the cloud yet because Amazon Web Services were not in existence, but we started having, you know, hosting costs and bandwidth costs, which were much, much, much cheaper, like 100 times cheaper than back in 1999. And certainly, because we were focusing on a portion of the features that will definitely build value for your product as opposed to trying to rebuild the entire stack, because we had really sort of much more modular pieces of software, you only needed, you know, 3 to 5 people to get a product off the ground and out the door. And so suddenly we started meeting companies which were only requiring 250, 500, 750 to $1,000 to get going. And, you know, in 2003, early 2004, VCs were still suffering and dealing with the consequences of the internet sort of bubble burst and trying to sort of, you know, work on their winners so that they can actually return their funds, because a lot of the companies they had invested in were had been decimated. And so there was very little interest from them to look at those startups where there was a clear gap between the amount of money that the fund needs to put to work, you know, typically $3 to $5 million, and what the companies actually needed, just a few $100,000. And that's why suddenly a few of us were willing or crazy enough to actually invest in those startups ended up becoming the primary source of funding for this new ecosystem. And because there was just a few of us, we sort of started working together, putting those syndicates of angel investors. And at that time, mostly we were investing or we were all investing our own money. Only Josh Koppelman from First Round Capital had put together a few vintage funds. So the first round capital funds were like $10, $12 million funds, which were vintage funds. So there was a 2004, 2005, 2006 fund. And he was actually investing, you know, as an institution, whereas all of us were any real pioneer of the model. And all the rest of us were investing our own money. And what we saw is, you know, that we could really put in $500,000 or $1 million and work very hard with the companies for 12 months, 18 months, and get them off the ground and then organize their Series A or Series B, whatever we call the next round at that time, with traditional VCs who would in turn put in $3 to $5 million and then get the company off to the races. And what that meant is that we had built this chunk of equity ownership to the tune of 20 to 25% in the cap table, where we had really sort of de-risked the value proposition of the company from the VC standpoint, where certainly they had a team, a product, and the initial sort of user footprint that allowed them to make a decision. What capital efficiency is often sort of misconstrued for is cheap startups, and that's really one of the big myths that I want to debunk today, which is that the work we do at the early stage is really to sort of take care of the initial launch and market risk. And so we can do that on a very capital efficient basis, which means that if we fail, not much money has actually been wasted. And that's really sort of the major benefit of capital efficiency. It's that the cost of failure, which is, as far as I'm concerned, the amount of money which I need to essentially put to risk and potentially waste to figure out that an idea is actually a bad idea, was a bad idea in the first place, is where sort of the equation really changed for us. It used to be that you had to invest $5 million to figure out whether something had legs, and now, typically, the first 250 or the first 500 give you a good sense as to whether whatever you're building has a shot in the market or not. And that's really the major difference. It's not so much that companies are cheap. You know, you could definitely see, and I have in the portfolio, companies which have validated, you know, their market opportunity and their initial sort of approach and gotten, you know, the first batch of users on $500,000, let's say, but then went on to raise a $5 million Series A, $10 million Series B, and a $50 million Series C. And so if you look at the total dollars in those companies, you could definitely see $15, $25, $50, $75 million of capital being invested. What differs from the good old days of Internet 1.0 is that the initial financing and the initial dollar at risk is much lower. And if you actually invest at that stage, it's still risky, but the dollar at risk is actually much lower. And so from an investor standpoint, it's actually a fantastic opportunity for people like you guys who are individual angels and people like us who are sort of, you know, professional angels turned micro VCs to actually get a good chunk of ownership in those really fast-growing companies for a minimum dollar in. Obviously, we take a lot of risk, but if we do a good job and the company sort of executes really well for the first 18 months of runway, whenever they raise that next round, typically there is a very nice markup that pays for the risk that we took. And so that's really the opportunity which I had seen back in 2004, which was that by creating this seed capital sort of infusion vehicle and working hard with the companies on their execution, there was an opportunity to get a lift in valuation between my round and the next round that would sort of pay for that risk. And essentially, as the company sort of scaled, would almost mechanically avoid the issue of dilution or over-dilution. And very often people say, well, you know, the problem with angel investing is that you get crushed by the next round because the rest of the investors in the upper rounds try to sort of get your level of ownership. And, you know, I have closed as of, I guess tomorrow we'll be closing, we're 106 investments in 7 years. And I've never been crushed, and I've never been recapped, and I've never been sort of subject to pay-to-play in a company which, you know, was doing well. Because obviously if you invest in a dog and at some point someone recaps it, it's fair game, you know, it's a dog. But the risk would be that you are adversely affected by a round of financing, you know, in that DES level, even if the company does well. What has been sort of, and that's never happened to us. What's interesting, even though those companies may actually raise quite a bit of money, is that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's rare that you see that you go much beyond the D round, unless it's for, you know, expansion round, growth rounds, which are typically at very high valuation, or secondary type, you know, rounds where management and early investors take a bit of money off the table. And so even though some companies might raise, you know, $80 million in financing, those financings are really sort of back-end loaded, and the dilution that you incur is reasonably limited. So, you know, in short, capital efficiency really means, and I should really mention something, which is that capital efficiency has applied really well to consumer internet startups. If you have to go into clean tech, into clean energy, into, you know, hardware, typically the capital efficiency might not apply. And to be honest, capital efficiency is a relative factor, meaning let's say that you're building a search engine. I'm an investor in Blacko, which is, I think, the most interesting search engine which has been built over the past 10 years. And, you know, we seeded the company with $3 million. And it proved its differentiation, marketability, and the fact that it really had built extremely interesting and powerful technology on $3 million. $3 million is actually a pretty hefty seed round. But if you look at, in the grand scheme of things, what it takes to actually scale a search engine, $3 million is nothing. And, you know, the next round for us was 17, and, you know, at some point, Blacko will raise a much larger round, you know, to scale. That just proves the point that you can actually prove your initial thesis on a limited, reasonable amount as compared to your category, and then you go off and scale your startup. I've also been very lucky to invest in a company called Fitbit, which is actually a hardware company, which has built one of those connected devices. It's a wireless pedometer. And the challenge with hardware, as you may know, if you invest in hardware, is that not only do you have to build the concept, market it, and so on and so forth, but you actually have to manufacture it. You actually have to get it produced by ODMs in Asia, and this is sort of easier said than done. And so it's very rare that you can actually build a capital-efficient startup in the hardware world because of that production issue. We were lucky to essentially raise a launch seed round, $2 million, that got Fitbit off the ground and built an extremely successful hardware business. Interestingly, it took us a year to figure out the mass production sort of issues that we had and where we were supposed to launch for December. So Christmas 2008, we launched in Christmas 2009. And had we not raised a large seed round, we would have died, you know, in 2009. So if you deal with capital efficiency, you really want to figure out what is the minimum runway that you need to give the startup so that they have a shot at proving themselves for the next round. Because you know that in most circumstances, the companies will not go to cash flow. The kinds of companies that we back are, you know, we try to back large sustainable companies. And one of the filters we apply is, can I see this company under, you know, normal circumstances and you know, non-superhuman sort of execution, can I see this company get to $100 million in revenue at some point, whether it's, you know, 4 years, 5 years, 7 years, doesn't matter, but does it have the legs and the potential scale to get there? So we build big companies, you know, at the early stage, which means that proving them might take some time and some hurdles. And so mentally, we try to at least give them 18 months of runway, 12 months, 15 months of execution, and then 3 to 6 months of fundraising. And sometimes, if you deal with, like a Fitbit, for example, we said 18 months is not going to be enough. If you look at a marketplace, where marketplaces require two sides of the market to come together, you know, typically a buyer and a seller, those are harder to build, and so we extend the runway. And mentally, we try and put enough cash in those companies, whilst, you know, remaining below the $1.5 to $2 million sort of threshold, to give them that sort of initial runway so they can prove themselves. Obviously, it's more an art than a science because you don't know what the startup that is starting to take off might need 1 year down the road. And to be honest, when we say we need to give them 18 to 24 months runway, that's sort of a maximum. It happens very often that companies are doing so well that very quickly – program that said, I'm not going to wait because I know that if I wait, A, it's going to be very competitive, and it might be even more expensive than I'm paying now, which is one of the dynamics in the market. So really figuring out what is sort of this runway that you're going to give to the company is very important. Likewise, it's very important to sort of figure out how you build your syndicate of investors. Typically, the way we like to do it is to have a couple of micro VC firms like, you know, our SoftTech, working with First Round, with True Ventures, with Harrison Mell, Michael Deering, with Steve Anderson at Baseline, with One Conway's group. We try and build a strong syndicate of professional investors. And then we bring in a bunch of angels who will be essentially selected on the basis of the value that they can deliver. In Silicon Valley, in consumer tech, unlike any other places and sector in the world, you actually are invited to invest as opposed to you selecting an investment, because there is so much demand today for investments that entrepreneurs can definitely choose the best investors for themselves. And, you know, it is what it is, right? It's kind of interesting that you have to sell yourself as an investor, but, you know, today the market is definitely a seller's market. And so figuring out how you fit in those ecosystems, how you can add value is important. But also what you want to make sure is that the pockets around the table are deep enough that if ever the company requires a bit of extra money and it does well, then there is that opportunity to do a bridge or some kind of an interim round to get the company to the next level. And so when you see those deals coming together with just angels or angel groups, you know, essentially not having mentally to reserve some buffer money for the investments, it means that, you know, those companies could get a chart for it. Word about the environment in which we are sitting in. So for about 3 years, I would say, the bulk of the financing, you know, from 2005 to 2008, bulk of the early stage financing was provided by this new category, you know, super angels and micro VCs. For me, the difference between super angels typically would be someone who invests his own money but does a lot of deals and gets quite involved, so almost a professional investor. And we were badged super angels even though we had raised institutional funds, which was a bit misleading. I like the micro VC categorization better. It's not great to be micro, but at least it's correct in the sense that we're definitely looking at a funnel of investments. We're applying an investment strategy and portfolio construction and capital allocation and so on and so forth, which is very much similar to how our friends on Sand Hill Road are operating, and we're really thinking about capital deployment and how we're going to support some of the companies with follow-on sort of capital and so on and so forth. So we are definitely a micro VC firm, and I would say that most of our peers and friends who are operating at the same stage as we are also sort of micro VCs. What's been happening for the past couple of years is traditional VCs have put in place programs, either separate funds or, you know, they've sort of carved out a portion of their $500 million funds, you know, to invest again at the early stage. And most often it's, you know, in complete symbiosis with us, because, you know, they can't really compete with us, because competing with us might mean that they cut themselves away from our deal flow. And because by definition, they need us to source the Series A and Series B opportunities, and we need them to actually fund those companies. And so it's a bit like, you know, the Cold War, where we all had nukes and we'll never use them because, by definition, we need each other. However, some of them have decided to go back to early-stage financing and invest in those companies as part of the seed round. And, you know, Greylock has put together this discovery fund. Some some funds like CRV have been very active, investing, you know, small amounts in many companies. Everyone essentially is trying in the VC world to figure out how to play with us in this new ecosystem in order to have access to interesting deals. Some are basically building very strong relationships with a few managers and make sure that they sit on top of their deal flow. Others try and get a seat at the table with a small investment. My personal stance, and everyone has a different strategy on that, is if you think that the traditional VC has a specific set of access experience, you know, partners who can be relevant to the startup that you're working on, it's perfectly fine to bring in one firm. I would always suggest to have the firm, and I've done that many times with, you know, Grey Oak or Trinity, to have the firm invest a lower amount than the lead angel or the lead micro VC, so that, you know, there's a clear demarcation of roles. You know, we've done that a couple of times where two-thirds of the round were brought in by a couple of micro VC firms, you know, 600, 300, something like that, and then the traditional VC would put in maybe 200, so that it's clear for the syndicate and for the outside who the lead is, so that if ever for some reason the firm decides not to do the next round, then there's no adverse sort of signaling happening. I would personally think twice about bringing, you know, three or four firms for 100K or 25K or 50K each in an early stage financing, because A, it's clear that they won't be able to deploy that much effort, and this value add that we're all trying to really create for the company will just not be there from them. And if ever you have too many firms in a deal and they all pass on the next round, then there will definitely be a negative signaling. And so I would be sort of careful if some of you sort of create put syndicates together and take a lead position when you do that. And just a word before we move to questions. I personally am always in favor of having one or two leads in a syndicate, so that you have clarity as to whose job it is to be the primary support for the company. Because if you have a syndicate which is just put together with a bunch of people putting in, you know, some of the same amount, 50, 100 or whatever, there is no clear support structure around the company. And you know, maybe the founders are so strong that they don't need that sort of level of help. But a lot of those companies are started by first-time entrepreneurs, and if ever, because let's put it this way, because it's so cheap to start, you have a bunch of first-time entrepreneurs, you know, trying to build the startup of their dreams, which is great because that's how, you know, amazing things are created when people sort of pursue their passion. The downside is that they might not have a lot of experience and therefore need a lot of help and support. And if ever you end up with a super structure, which is a hodgepodge of, you know, people sort of coming together around the financing but don't feel that they have a mission, which is to support the companies, then, you know, bad things will happen, because by definition, there's always, you know, issues, there are always issues in, you know, during the course of the first 12, 18 months where, you know, a bit of adult supervision and experience, you know, needs to be contributed to the team so that they avoid, you know, essentially cratering what was potentially a good idea. So that's basically the few remarks which I wanted to make, and we have about 15 minutes if you guys have any questions or things that you'd like me to dig into.
Okay, perfect. Jeff, thank you so much for your comments. In terms of asking questions, there are two ways to do it. Either go ahead and hit *6 on your phone to unmute your mic, or you can just click on the screen to type out your question. Jeff, a number of people have already submitted questions, so I'll just go ahead and rattle one or two of them off. And then if anyone has a live question, just please just hit *6 and barge your way in. But one of the questions submitted was, have you noticed a change in whether VCs are willing and able to participate in the next round? And a related question of, you know, what are the best ways you have seen for angels to manage that risk?
So is it the appetite for VCs to do the next round, regardless of whether they were investors in the seed round or?
Yeah, I think that was the nature of the question.
So I've seen many companies where, you know, the company has had one or two VCs involved in the seed round, and you know, so let's be clear. If it's a company which is hot, which has traction, which, you know, is clearly building something that works in the marketplace, it doesn't matter whether you have, you know, VCs or not, because there is a lot of interest in this environment from a lot of firms to try and capture, you know, the Series A, the first $3 to $5 million opportunity in a hot property. And so for those, there's never an issue because there is a lot of people who are trying to line up for those financing, and they are willing and they pay up for those. Challenge sometimes is, you know, how do you get a company that is doing okay but not great to get the next round? And typically, if you have chosen your VC partner that you brought in the seed round, you know, probably you've been working with them all along to sort of figure out what, in their view as insiders, would be sort of necessary milestones for the company to hit to get that financing done. And you use them as a proxy for figuring things out. Sometimes, you know, you have chosen someone who's really aligned with the market the company is in, and therefore they are a good proxy. Sometimes you actually sort of figure out that the initial thesis of the company is actually not the one that they kept, and they built a slightly different product. And then, you know, you have someone who's sort of interesting to get feedback from, but might not be sort of the right funding source for the next round. And so the thing we do is, because we've done pretty much investments with everyone in our place, we know exactly, you know, who does what and who is interested in what kind of companies. And so when it's time for us to go do the next round, Series A, Series B financing of the companies, we always have sort of a short list of five firms that, you know, and they're never the same, obviously, that allow us to get this initial market feedback as to how interesting a given opportunity is from a Series B sort of investor perspective. And if we see that there is something that works, then, you know, we'll just work hard on getting the company financed. Sometimes we sort of see that the feedback from the market is, hey, kind of interesting, but not clear there is a market opportunity that is big enough for us, blah, blah, you know, the usual sort of is it big enough test that the VCs have. And to be honest, if after 6 to 8 weeks you don't have a good feel of what it takes to get the company financed, it means that maybe it's actually going to be much harder. So either you actually go for a let's get ability, you know, strategy, if it works, if you have revenues, and if you don't, then you go for an acquisition opportunity because, you know, in this environment, there is so much need for talent in the market that you can actually, you know, get money back and recycle reasonably easily if you have actually backed a talented sort of technology team.
If anyone has live questions, you can go right ahead. Another question that was submitted is, have you found the average valuation in Silicon Valley to be much higher than other parts of the country? And, you know, of course, you're funding from out of several different cities. You know, how are you handling that? And are you finding valuations elsewhere to be so much more attractive that it's pulling you like a magnet? Or, you know, any thoughts on that topic?
So we do 80% of our investments in Silicon Valley, 15% in New York, and then we do, you know, a few random things in Los Angeles and Seattle. And I don't really sort of look at deal flow anywhere else. I would say that I haven't seen any real gap between New York and Silicon Valley in terms of valuation. I would say that what used to be $3 million pre-money valuation, maybe in 2007 is now, you know, 5 million pre. Certainly there are companies which are raising at a much, much higher sort of valuation. You know, it's not rare these days to see something floating around, you know, seed stage, no product built yet, and, you know, 10 million pre. We just pass on those. I mean, unless the team is exceptional and we think that the opportunity is warranted, won't do the deal. In terms of going outside of Silicon Valley to find sort of cheaper deals, I can tell you that my most expensive seed investment is actually in Los Angeles, funny enough. So I think what you do is you look at the team, the opportunity, the product, the market opportunity. You look at, you know, what's the fair price for this deal, regardless of the location. You do take into account the ability to hire talent. And to be honest, it's much more challenging today in Silicon Valley than anywhere else. So you just look at the value of the deal and make your decision. I think, you know, in some cases it's okay to pay up, but you can't invest thinking and behaving as if, you know, what you're doing is the next Facebook, because 99.9% of the companies are not the next Facebook.
Another question, is the horse becoming more important than the jockey as angel exits keep speeding up and the strategic buyers are more interested in the product than buying a product management team?
I think it's really dangerous. I think for us, we look at both. Some of my peers are saying, I just look at the jockey because the horse is going to change and what matters is the jockey. And, you know, I'm not saying they're wrong. I will just make the remark that, you know, even great teams can come up with shitty products and do, you know, not so interesting things. It has happened many times in the past. And we at SoftTech see so many opportunities. We typically get 200 to 300 opportunities, qualified opportunities a month. And we do, you know, one or two investments. And so we look at really scoring high on the three factors, the team, the product, and the market opportunity.
Another question. What upcoming trends do you see that other angels should be on the lookout for and buy into that you think will yield strong exits in the future?
The trend that we really like and are actually investing a lot of money into is what I call the mobile services economy. So we were early investors in a number of companies which became very large footprint on the iPhone. Tapios comes to mind. They have now 50 million phones installed with their game, Tap Revenge. And so we've seen the benefit of having such a large footprint. The challenge is that, you know, the monetization on the mobile platform is just not there. So if you look at the average revenue per user of, you know, your web-based sort of user versus your mobile-based user, there is a massive gap today. And so what we've started to invest in is much more sort of infrastructure products that take advantage of this, you know, 250 million sort of smartphone units being deployed and growing very, very fast, to essentially treat the smartphone like a very cheap, you know, scanner, you know, camera, something which can do sort of remote computing, and build services around that. Recently, we announced the launch of we launched GigWalk, GigWalk, which is sort of a mobile workforce enablement platform, which is fascinating because we can offer large companies, you know, the ability to post 100,000 or maybe a million, actually, jobs on that platform, which can require just, you know, someone going to a location, taking a picture, or actually answering a very short survey. And so what we believe is that those smartphone platforms will definitely enable a mobile economy, and we've been investing heavily into that.
Another question, I think, and this might be the last question given the time, have you seen more strategic investors in follow-on rounds, or typically if they are interested, they want to buy it outright?
I've seen more of early acquisitions than people sort of coming in as strategic investors and then building the companies. I think it also depends on the company's reaction when they get the call for, you know, a potential takeout. Certainly, the fact of the matter is that we by investing very early can make money along the return curve, whether the company sells for, you know, $25, $30, $50 million after one round, or sells for $250 million after, you know, two or three rounds. And so we are much more ambivalent to when the company sells than our peers on 10-year-old road, because by definition, if you have put in, you know, $5 million at 23 and the company sells for 50, well, you made, you know, 2x your money. Whereas if we invest $1 million at full pre, then we made 10 times our money. So we've seen a lot of those early takeouts. I would say if someone comes to you and says, I want to buy you, and you say no, then maybe there's a conversation around, you know, okay, well, let's invest. But to be honest, I'm always wary of getting strategics involved in early rounds. So I would say getting a strategic investor or two in a Series C or Series D, yeah, sure. But before that, it's rare that it works. I mean, Fab is kind of a counterexample where the Washington Post is a strategic investor from day one, but because of the distribution agreement that we have with the Post on the very specific product. So in some cases, you know, there are some circumstances that sort of make it palatable. Otherwise, I would say just go with financial investors in the first two or three rounds, and then if it makes sense, figure out the strategic positioning. I mean, the position of getting strategic involved.
Okay, perfect. Jeff, thank you so much for taking an hour to share your thoughts with so many angels across North America today. Your involvement and dedication to entrepreneurism sets a high benchmark for others to follow. Thank you again.
My pleasure. It was really interesting.
Very good. For all the angel groups that were able to join us across North America, we appreciate your participating. Hopefully this Angel Knowledge Series will be useful in your efforts. Some quick notations about upcoming events. Everyone on the call today may listen to past events and participate in future events at no charge. You may see a full listing of future events at angelpool.org. Again, that is angelpool.org. And then clicking on the Knowledge tab, there are a number of high-profile speakers and panels coming up that will be discussing various aspects of angel investing, best practices, including Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn and a number of others. The next few events are on June 23rd at 2 p.m. There will be a panel on deal flow and quality best practices. On July 28th at 2 p.m., there will be a panel on minimizing legal and other fees and safely reducing fees at closing. On August 26th at 2 p.m., Josh Koppelman of First Round Ventures will be discussing helping your portfolio companies to the next level. On September 8th at 3 p.m. will be Reid Hoffman of Greylock Partners and Chair of LinkedIn on Internet and Investing 2.0. This call was recorded and will be available by tomorrow at both angelpool.org and angelcapitalassociation.com. Special thank you again, Jeff, for your taking the time to speak to us. We really appreciate it. The call is now concluded. Thank you all, and have a great day.
You are about to end. You are the only person.